Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
This program is supported by listeners. My personal thanks to Deborah Hoover, Tom McAfee, he's recovering, Michael McMillan, and Margaret Anderson. If you'd like to help out and you're able, go to my website at peterbcollins.com. On the right-hand side of the homepage are your links to our voluntary subscriptions that start as low as $5 a month. And thank you for your support. On today's podcast, two powerful views critical of the Obama administration's intervention in Libya. Journalist Robert Perry will join us in the second segment, and he'll focus his criticism in part on the American media cheerleading the Obama-Clinton efforts under the NATO banner in Libya. But first, globetrotting journalist Pepe Escobar returns to our program. We spoke to him last year in an edition of the Boiling Frogs interview series with Sibel Edmonds. And today he is in South America, in Brazil, which is what he loosely calls home. Pepe Escobar writes for Asia Times, their website atimes.com. And he's also the author of three books, Globalistan, How the Globalized World is Dissolved into Liquid War, Red Zone Blues, a snapshot of Baghdad during the surge, and his most recent book, Obama Does Globalistan, and that was published in 2009. Pepe Escobar, great to talk to you again.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Peter.
And Pepe, I want you to give us your uncensored view of America's role in this new alleged coalition effort to protect the people of Libya. And I'll offer you some of the commentary from President Obama, but don't hold back. And we are not censored on this program, so you can use whatever language you're comfortable with in describing what's going on. Okay, can you live with those ground rules?
Well, that's what I do with Asia Times. I don't hold back. And in fact, I get a lot of email from readers from all over, from Uganda to Stockholm, saying that they are not used to reading that kind of stuff in their local, regional, national newspapers, because with Asia Times, we don't hold back. We are totally independent. So with you, it's going to be the same thing, and even more.
Well, you've written some powerful posts. You're writing almost every day, and I encourage people to bookmark or favorite atimes.com, because you do offer perspectives that don't show up in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and certainly not on America's corporate-controlled broadcast media. First up, Pepe, who benefits most from the U.S.-led intervention that comes short of throwing Gaddafi out? That's not the stated goal. It is the aspiration of this effort, however.
Exactly. And the thing is that as we speak, people from the Foreign Office in London and from the State Department, they are doing everything they can to twist UN Resolution 1973. And this was being discussed over 2 years ago by the people who abstain from the vote. This means the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, the big emerging powers, and Germany. They abstain. The BRICs, they tend to coordinate their voting before any major voting, international voting. And what I got from diplomats, from at least three of them, was that we simply cannot vote for this because it's an open-ended. The way it is redacted, it will be twisted. And that's exactly what's happening as we speak. Well, to start with, Odyssey Dawn, it's not a rewriting of Homer, Like, we don't have a James Joyce nowadays at the Pentagon who's going to rewrite the Odyssey for the 21st century.
No.
Obviously not. It's much more tawdry, cheap, and squalid operation, really. Basically, it is an American war. It didn't start as an American war. It started as a French war. So, okay, let's backtrack a little bit to October 2010.
Okay.
There's a guy called Nouri Mesmari. He was the chief of protocol of Gaddafi. They had problems, simmering problems for a few years. He defected to France last October. And in France, he was approached by the French intelligence, and they start talking about Gaddafi's assets, especially military assets, and a concept evolved that maybe we could start a revolution in eastern Libya, in the Cyrenaica region. Their man over there was a colonel who also defected from Tripoli. This colonel was based in Benghazi. So these two characters, plus French intelligence, they masterminded the whole thing. So what we have here technically is a military coup against a, let's put it mildly, a military dictatorship. Gaddafi is a military dictatorship. Right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So we have a military coup, which is also a tribal war, because these guys are not part of the tribes affiliated with Gaddafi.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the Gaddafia, his tribe, but other tribes were affiliated with like the Valfala. Valfala is 1 million people, at least, and they were pro-Gaddafi. So by mid-January, they had all the pieces in place. The French wanted bad, the French government wanted badly to go into this because there were some contracts that Sarkozy had signed with Gaddafi to sell Rafale fighters.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very close to Dassault in France, Sarkozy, and probably built some nuclear power plants. And Gaddafi said, no, I don't want to do this anymore. Plus, there is an internal rivalry between France and Italy inside the European Union. Berlusconi and Eni, the Italian energy giant, had a very, as we know, had very, very close contacts with Gaddafi. Everybody remembers Berlusconi kissing Gaddafi's hand. When Gaddafi went to Rome, he planted his tent inside of Berlusconi's palace.
Mm-hmm.
You name it. He used to visit Berlusconi's villa in Sardinia and in Milano.
And, so and did, did Silvio share Ruby with Muammar?
In fact, Silvio Bunga Bunga, as he's being called
right.
in Italy, man. He's going to court next month, by the way. So
that's right.
We should hold our breath on
and,
that.
And you are not a witness, is that right, Pepe?
No, I've never been to Silvio's villa. But my Italian friends, I have some good friends in the Italian media, especially Stampa and La Repubblica. They tell me absolutely outrageous stories.
Yeah.
Some of them they published, and some they didn't. Exactly.
Right. Uh-huh. Okay, so
everybody
knows
this is going on in Italy, but the thing is Berlusconi controls virtually the whole country. He controls all the media.
That's right.
He controls most of the politicians. The thing he does not control is a few independent judges, including these people who are going to try him next month. So we're going to see what happens.
Right.
Okay, anyway, so now we come to mid-January, and all the pieces are in place for let's say, Eastern Cyrenaica / France intervention in Libya. At the same time, there is, of course, a legitimate February 17 youth movement in Libya. These are students, intellectuals, you know, liberal professionals. They are secular. They really want a democratic country. They don't want everything monopolized by one family. But day after the revolution started, what was decided in Paris started, they were marginalized. And nowadays what we're seeing is the same thing that happened with Iraq. You know those famous exiles that live in the U.S. for 20 years? Now they're coming back, and they are in positions of power inside the Transitional Council, which renamed itself. Now it's in internal National Interim National Council, INC. By the way, the same acronym of the fabled INC of Ahmed Shalabi in the run-up to the war in Iraq in 2003.
Right.
So, yes, in a sense, we are having a really, really bad remix of an already horrible B-movie.
And in place of Shalabi, we have Khalifa Hifter. You were the first to report on this former Libyan army colonel. Tell us about his connection, presumably, to the Central Intelligence Agency.
Exactly. This guy, he was leading Gaddafi's troops in a war in Chad in the late 80s. He then defected, and he went to live in the U.S. And guess where he was living? In Vienna, Virginia, which is about a, 3 or 4 mile drive from Langley.
Right.
So we don't have definitive proof, of course, that he was a CIA, that he lived or he is employed or he's still working as a CIA asset. But if you make the connections are there, obviously. And the fact that he came back after 20 years and immediately became the military commander of the whole operation in Cyrenaica is, I would say, extremely fishy to start with.
Yeah, yeah.
Plus, that's the defectors, the former Gaddafi Ministry of Justice, which is now one of the leaders of the movement as well. And at the London conference this Tuesday was crazy because when I read the manifesto that they distributed to all journalists, I read it online. People sent me online from there. This first thing that struck me is, wow, this was redacted in Washington. You know, all the, you know, the right catchphrases, the right points about democracy, freedom, secular country, not a single mention of Islam by name. And then they were saying, no, this was redacted in Arabic and this is a translation. No, it was the other way around. It was written in English by somebody, we don't know who, and then translated into Arabic. And many journalists noticed this right away as well, including the guys from The Guardian. I think from what I read in European press, they were the only ones in European press who mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so now we have a leadership, we have returnees, former exiles, we have a platform. So who's backing these people apart from France because of commercial interests? Well, that's where the American war starts. So we were discussing before how Hillary Clinton, the new Athena in Greek mythology rewritten by the U.S., and her army of combat women, that's Susan Rice at the U.N. and Samantha Power,
mm-hmm.
they practically sold this war to Obama, or they cornered Obama into accepting this war. And then there was the good guy, bad guy, game being played between Hillary Clinton and Bob Gates at the Pentagon. The Pentagon didn't have to play this game because everybody wanted, the Pentagon wants this war for two very important reasons. In fact, this what they were discussing this past week was a transfer of the war from the Pentagon to the Pentagon. From the Africa, exactly. From AFRICOM to NATO. So we have to backtrack. Once more, AFRICOM is the African Command.
Right.
It's based in Stuttgart, Germany. None of the 53 African countries wanted to have AFRICOM based in an African country. They need a beachhead badly. They have a base in Djibouti, but that's not enough. They want a big base in a major African country, preferably in the Mediterranean, because the really strategic sea in terms of Africa is the Mediterranean, which NATO considers a Mediterranean lake, a NATO lake. Not yet, because there are three countries who are outside of the arrangement for the moment. And one of them is exactly Libya. So NATO and AFRICOM, they work in tandem. AFRICOM poses like a sort of humanitarian organization who's going to train countries against terrorist activities all over Africa. No wonder most of them, if not all of them, didn't buy that and didn't want Africa in their own countries. At the same time, NATO wants to control the whole Mediterranean. And they have, for that, they have not only NATO partners in Europe, but they have what they call partnership programs. And that includes most of the countries in or around the Mediterranean or inside the Mediterranean, the islands as well,
mm-hmm.
Malta, Cyprus, all that. The only countries who are not either part of NATO or part of this partnership, there are only five, and one of them is Libya. Only three, I'm sorry. Lebanon is not. And Syria, Lebanon, and
mm-hmm.
Libya.
Mm-hmm.
Lebanon, there's a NATO blockade against Lebanon since 2006. Syria, we know what's happening nowadays.
Right.
There is, of course, a yearning for democracy in Syria, but at the same time, there's a lot of destabilizing forces who are trying to profit from it. And, you know, Libya, from the, let's say, from the Pentagon optics, which was one of their favorite terms,
right,
was the weak link. So it suited marvelously for the Pentagon structure to have a war started by Afrikaners so they could legitimize Afrikaners, even inside the U.S., because Afrikaners basically is a scam for the arms industry. So they needed to legitimize this as being part of a war, a big, big, major international war. And then they transferred the whole thing to NATO, and NATO can finally, you know, put the pieces together for the control of the Mediterranean as a NATO lake. So the only two missing pieces are are Syria and Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, what is this? The Pentagon profits on all fronts from all this. Plus, they sell the public the fiction that the U.S. is not part of the war and NATO will be part of the war. Anyone who knows how NATO works knows that any major military decision is taken by the U.S.
Right.
It's not taken by the Danish or the Swedes or the Finnish. You know, it's Americans. During the 90s, I used to go to Brussels a lot. I was covering the European Union, and I had to go to that goddamn headquarters of NATO in Mons, near Brussels. And this is how it works. It's absolutely horrible. It's the Pentagon controlling a bunch of generals from small European countries who are always squabbling against each other, like replicating the mode of the mode that the European Union works, in fact.
Uh-huh.
So this is what we got. So who's profiting from all this? AFRICOM and NATO. So basically, the Pentagon and American military agendas. Plus, there's what the French like to say, the non-dit, you know, something that we don't say inside the whole picture, which is Saudi Arabia. They are very clever at disguising themselves and being very quiet. So for this, we need to analyze something extremely crucial, which is the Arab League vote that led to UN Resolution 1973. There is this myth being sold by virtually anyone in the U.S., if you go to any TV network, that we are there because of the UN, and we are there because the Arab League told us to be there. Wrong. Arab League has 22 members. Six of them are Gulf Cooperation Council, GCC. This means top dog Saudi Arabia, and the other Sheikh Thumb's Emirates. They voted for the no-fly zone for obvious reasons, because this is what Saudi Arabia wanted, so the others go just follow the top dog. It involves not only commercial interests, it involves more influence from Wahhabism in Libya,
mm-hmm.
which was very fought, you know, harshly by Gaddafi.
Right. Wahhabi Islam is the most extreme fundamentalist version,
absolutely.
Or at least one of them.
Mm-hmm. To essentially, we should put it that Islam, 7th century Islam as applied to contemporary living.
Okay.
This is what Wahhabism basically is.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's a, you know, very few people talked about that as well. The extremely bad blood between King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia and Gaddafi. This, I don't know, probably many of your listeners will remember a meeting in Cairo at the Arab League in 2002 in the run-up to the war on Iraq. And there was this huge discussion with open mics between King Abdullah and Gaddafi. And Gaddafi was accusing King Abdullah of being of having sold out to the Americans the invasion of Iraq. And he said, no, we cannot allow a Western Christian country to invade a Muslim country like that. He knew it was going to happen. And since then, you know, the secret services on both sides have been, you know, basically at odds. There's talk with no proof that Gaddafi put a contract to kill King Abdullah and vice versa. Anyway, so the House of Saud wanted Gaddafi out of the picture. So they manipulated the vote in the Arab League. They had the 6 votes, and they managed to pass the Arab League resolution in favor of a no-fly zone with only 9 votes, because only 11 countries were there to vote. The Arab League has 22. 11 voted. And of these 11, 6 were GCC countries. So they only had to twist the arms of 3 more. One of them was Jordan, very close to Saudi Arabia.
Right.
And Syria and Algeria voted against it. They were there voting, but they voted against it.
Mm-hmm.
So we had 9 countries out of 22 who voted for the no-fly zone, which was the basis of the UN resolution. So when they voted on a weekend, if I'm not mistaken. On Tuesday, the French and the English had the final draft ready, and they started lobbying all the other members of the Security Council. They voted on Thursday. And, like I told you before, and this is absolutely crucial, the top 4 emerging powers in the world, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, mm-hmm. they abstained. They said, this is too dangerous. We simply cannot endorse something that is redacted this way. And Germany, for different reasons, because of internal politics, because there's most people in Germany, they are extremely pacifist. They would never contemplate the idea of Germany, for instance, sending troops to an African country. And obviously, they had to abstain as well. So the myth that's been sold that international community and the UN approved this whole thing and is there to save the Libyan people, as they say, they don't even say who they are saving and what for. It's basically the U.S., Britain, France, not all NATO countries. There are 28 NATO countries, and the coalition, the last I heard, there were only 16 taking part.
Mm-hmm.
And from the Arab world, there's only 2. Qatar, which starts sending Mirages early this week, actually, on Monday. And the United Arab Emirates, which are probably going to take care of humanitarian help. No Mirages or F-16s from the UAE. Mm-hmm. So this is what's being sold to us as the international community.
Right. and so, Pepe...
This was the short story, of course.
And it's important to note the abstentions at the UN Security Council, but the U.S. used its influence to prevent a veto, particularly from Russia. And we know that there's disagreement between Putin and Medvedev about this adventure. And so the U.S. took the absence of a veto and ignored all of the abstentions and said, look, we have a U.N. resolution. Now, on one hand, from a domestic American point of view, this is modest progress. Because Bush would not have waited for any U.N. action. He probably would have just operated unilaterally. And Obama wants to take credit for rather quickly assembling what he calls consensus and what he calls a coalition. But each of these is founded on half-truths in a best case.
Yeah, you're totally right, Peter. In fact, it's... don't paying any respect to international law, which was the case of the Bush neocon invasion of Iraq. And now the humanitarian imperialist logic that we invoke R2P, as they say, responsibility to protect, and we go there to save civilians. But it's very selective. You want to save civilians in a country that has strategic value for Western corporations and for the Pentagon military, a country where there's no U.S. bases, in fact, in a crucial NATO lake, which is the case of Libya. And obviously this does not apply to Yemen, where the U.S. is financing an absolutely horrible regime to fight counterterrorism. And in fact, it only, you know, the situation in terms of security, I mean, only degraded after these past few years. It doesn't apply especially to Bahrain, where the fifth fleet is there, is the Persian Gulf. It's protected by Saudi Arabia. There's only a causeway between eastern Saudi Arabia and Bahrain.
Right.
And the U.S. simply cannot think of defending 70% of the population of Bahrain, even if they are all civilians. And they were involved in peaceful protests since February against a Sunni dictatorship, basically, 230-year-old Sunni monarchy, the Al-Khalifas, who were also killing their own people in the main square of Manama with live ammunition. And this was proof.
Well, and,
you know,
and Pepe,
selective.
Let's take a moment here to talk about Bahrain, because I do think that it's a critical contradiction of the statement that the president made in his speech this past Monday night, because he used Libya as an example and said that some nations can stand by while atrocities occur, but the United States is different. That's a paraphrase. It's not an explicit quote.
Yes. But
that was the intent of his message, and yet he did not even acknowledge the clear contradiction between what we're doing in Libya, our ongoing support for the royal family in Saudi Arabia, the fact that Gates was in Bahrain meeting with the king there just days before, nearly 2,000 Saudi police and military rolled across the causeway that you referenced. And so it appears to me that Gates, the bad cop on Libya, is the guy who's giving the green light to the royal family in Bahrain to crack down as much as necessary. And the other important aspect here is that the virus in Bahrain could spread to Saudi Arabia, where where the Sunni-Shia divide is somewhat similar to Bahrain.
Exactly. The only difference in Saudi Arabia is that the Shiites are 15% of the whole population. In Bahrain, they are 70% or maybe even more. The thing is, the Shiites in Saudi Arabia, they are all in the eastern part or the northeastern part of Saudi Arabia, which is the oil-producing area. And in fact, the key resistant city in eastern Saudi Arabia is not very far from the causeway that goes to Manama in Bahrain. So for the Al Khalifas, they immediately went public. If you were reading the Arabic press like a month ago or so, there was a minister of interior, one of the princes, saying, giving interviews every day, saying this is an Iranian plot, and it was not. So for any independent observer, it's clear that the grievances expressed by the people in Bahrain, they are legitimate, and they've been there for years, actually, if not decades. They have a prime minister who's in power for almost 40 years. The crown prince is considered to be slightly more modernizing in a Saif al-Islam Qaddafi way, mm-hmm. compared to the King Hamad, which is extremely reactionary. He is a close cousin of the House of Saud practices. And Saudi Arabia basically keeps Bahrain under watch all the time. So in the beginning, they didn't know exactly what to do. So how do we do it? So they had to coordinate to the Americans, as you said, a response. And it was a matter of 48 hours. Gates was there on a Saturday. They invaded on a Sunday night, early Monday.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing, the way I see it, and I've been thinking about this 24/7 for the past 2 months, is Saudi Arabia finally organized a counter-revolutionary plan against the Arab Spring or the Arab Revolt, or whichever way you want to call it. They coordinated with the Americans and say, look, we're going to squash this whole thing, especially here in our backyard in the Gulf. We have GCC support because everybody thinks along our line. And we're going to help you with Libya as well. So this is basically what's going on. It's a huge counter-revolutionary process where the Americans are working side by side with the British and the French, and especially Saudi Arabia. So what we don't know is that what Egyptians, Bahrainis, Yemenis, Tunisians, in the long run, how they're going to react to this. And if they are already identifying the source of the counter-revolution. Skimming the Arabic press, I have the feeling that they are, especially when you read the comments in most of these papers or the blogs. They know that this was going on. Look, maybe we have to take a back seat, but we'll keep up the pressure. We know this is a long-term Arab revolt. We're not going to have democracies tomorrow or in 2011, but the seeds are there, and it's going to be a long-term process. It is a revolutionary process, but the counter-revolution came much earlier than many people expected.
Well, and Pepe, my sense, and I'd like your thought about this, is that Obama and his team, including Clinton and Gates, were caught flat-footed by the fast-breaking developments in Egypt. And we attempted, in a very ugly way, to solidify our support and that of our allies around Suleiman, the architect of the torture program, the vendor that the United States turned to when we wanted to hijack people, kidnap people, and send them to Egypt to be tortured. And we were prepared to embrace Omar Suleiman, the instant vice president that Mubarak installed, as the guy we could control, the Egyptian who America and Israel could do business with. And the army leadership quickly took care of that. And I still don't know where Suleiman is. I haven't heard a peep from him since mid-January. But it appears to me that they made a pact or made a commitment not to repeat the mistakes of Egypt and allow these popular revolutions to get out of Western control. And so Libya seems to present as the first case study where, given your reporting, about this Colonel Khalifa Hifter, the former Libyan colonel who was spending all that time in Virginia, 20 years, if he in fact is our puppet, who we have picked to lead the opposition, then that takes care of one of the unanswered questions that Obama has been dodging, which is who are these rebels and who takes over if somehow we succeed in getting Gaddafi to quit or he is killed. And so we're seeing the developments of a fairly neat package of the counter-revolution that you alluded to.
Absolutely. So we can even make a comparison between the orderly transition. Remember, this was the White House or State Department catchword for Egypt in the beginning. We all remember Hillary Clinton saying in the beginning that Mubarak's government was stable and he was a valuable ally. This is on record. We all remember Washington power elite saying exactly the same thing. We all also remember that Erdogan, the prime minister of Turkey, went live on Al Jazeera from the beginning, and he said to the whole Muslim world and a worldwide audience, I'm standing with the protesters. None of it coming from Washington, of course. And in the middle, they were betting on, he was being called by the people in Tahrir Square, Sheikh al-Torture, our friend Omar Suleiman. And this was supposed to be the guy to lead the orderly transition.
Right.
And Obama, only at the last, very last minute, said publicly, live to the whole world, we want Mubarak to go. He never said that explicitly from the beginning, like other leaders were saying. Not from Europe, obviously not. The French and the British resisted till the end. The best example that I can find is Erdogan from Turkey, because Turkey, they have an extremely important role as the re-emerging power in the Middle East, let's put it this way. Not in an Ottoman fashion, but culturally, as an economic model, as a mix of Islam and politics, as a democracy and all that. So people in the Arab world, they look at Turkey as definitive a model. So compare this with the disorderly transition that the Americans, the French, and the British are trying to conduct in Libya. The same Iraq war scheme, you know, returnees, exiles, people with dodgy reputations, some declared CIA assets, some dodgy CIA assets, marginalizing the local opposition, which is, in this case is the February 17 youth movement in Libya. Like, there was not a single representative of these young guys at the London conference, for instance. Everybody that was at the London conference, they were former exiles, speaking good English. Of course, they all lived in the U.S., you know. So it's very easy to conduct. It's a disorderly transition with the tomahawks applied. You know, it's a very peculiar cake, legitimized by humanitarian imperialism. So if you are one of those Pentagon or State Department ghost writers, you can come up with fabulous nicknames for this operation. Way beyond Odyssey Dawn, for instance.
Well, there's some guys in the gay community here in San Francisco who are having a lot of fun with Odyssey Dawn.
it's a stripper, right?
it's subject to many interpretations. Pepe, in the piece that you wrote called Queen Hillary of Libya, posted today, you write, there you have it, the whole package. A Western puppet regime, Western boots on the ground, a squalid Western protectorate. Goodbye to Libya's sovereignty. And this only a few hours after Obama passionately told the world this was just a humanitarian mission.
Yes, because now, especially after the London conference, on Tuesday, the whole plot now is laid bare. They are trying to subvert an already open-ended UN resolution. If they can't, they'll come up with another UN resolution. Like, I'm almost betting that we're gonna have another UN vote probably in 3 weeks, 4 weeks, or maybe by early June, because this stalemate is going to stay. this stalemate could go on forever. If you look at what's been happening in these past 2 days, you know, in Braga, Ras Lanuf, and all that, you have these driving guys supported by airstrikes. They advance 200, 300 miles. And then Gaddafi changed his tactics. Now he doesn't have tanks anymore. So now he's fighting a Mao Zedong-style guerrilla war. So he's fighting a guerrilla with guerrilla tactics. And no wonder they are progressing as well, because not only they have a good army, a trained army, unlike the guerrillas, but they have local support in many of these cities. They even have cells implanted in Benghazi as well. So the stalemate could go on not only for months, but for years. So, in fact, it's not the Odyssey, it's the Iliad. You remember the Iliad? There were 9 years of fighting before they came up with the Trojan horse.
Mm-hmm.
So this is more the Iliad than the Odyssey.
And so, Pepe, as Americans look at this, number one, we have domestic issues about the president's failure to consult with the Congress under the War Powers Resolution and get any authority whatsoever to participate in this alleged coalition attack on Libya. We also have unspecified issues about how we're paying for the American involvement, but we're told not to worry about that. They'll just peel off a few tomahawks from Afghanistan, I guess.
Yeah.
At any rate, Americans in general are sitting still for this, saying that we rescued tens of thousands of people from imminent slaughter in Benghazi. And then they, in the same way that Bush Sr. first demonized Noriega and then personalized the Desert Storm operation around Saddam Hussein, we are told to focus on what an evil person Muammar Gaddafi is. And this way of manipulating American public opinion and avoiding the very tough questions, I have to say, is working. And with the support of the American media, which we'll talk about next with Bob Perry, this is working out fairly well for Obama, who has not made this into a major war. He explicitly didn't use the Oval Office to deliver his talk to the American people the other night. He downplayed this as a crisis by going to Brazil and not even really addressing the American public about it for 9 days. And all that said, there is some internal squabbling among Democrats about war powers, and there's a lot of flip-flopping among Republicans trying desperately to find a way to oppose Obama in any way they can. But the net result is that Americans appear to be unoffended by what Obama has done and, to some extent, supportive.
Yes. Look, there's a poll today. I was reading that like a few minutes ago. Apparently, it's even. Huh? Apparently, 50% of Americans are pro and 48 against. So he has not convinced the bulk of the American electorate about this operation. And if the stalemate goes on, as it will, expect people to be asking really, really tough questions. And by the way, when you mentioned Brazil, progressive people in Brazil, they are absolutely furious because Obama launched a war from Brazilian soil. Brazil is an extremely pacifist country. They abstain from the vote in the UN. And if you talk to any progressive here, they say, look, it's crazy. He comes here to promote, you know, very close ties between the, you know, the two big powers in the Western Hemisphere. He treats us like equals for the first time. And then he launches a war while he's talking to our president. And then he sets up a war room in a hotel in Rio to conduct the Tomahawk bombing of Libya. So I'll tell you, Obama's popularity in Brazil was close to 80%. After that, you know, we're talking about Bush rates now.
Yeah.
So this is one small detail. Basically, convincing the American population is easy when you have the machinery of the White House, the State Department, the Pentagon, and of course the U.S. mainstream media. Like I follow Al Jazeera, both of them all the time, Arabic and English, but I also follow CNN and Fox. So every night I'm watching Anderson Cooper, the savior of the Arab world. And, you know, the guys who go to Anderson Cooper 360 every day, they are seeing exactly the same thing. They are defending, apart from Fuad Ajami, who used to be a neocon, then he became an Arab liberator, and now he's criticizing Obama for the intervention. Everybody else is saying, no, this is the right decision. Nobody talks about, among other things, what's happening in the Ivory Coast, where there's a pre-genocide going on in the Ivory Coast at the moment. Like the Gabo, who lost the presidential elections, he's arming militias all over the country. So this could be absolutely horrendous. Nobody talks about what happened in 2006 when Israel killed 1,500 civilians in southern Lebanon at least.
Right.
And then the invasion of Gaza in the end of 2008. At least 1,500 civilians, women, children as well, killed as well. Nobody talks about this. So the selectivity of it all is glossed over by virtually every mainstream media commentator. But the thing, like I told you before, in the Arab world, they see this. And in the Muslim world at large as well, they see this in Indonesia, in Malaysia, you know, not only in the Arab world, the whole Muslim world. And in Turkey. In Turkey, for instance, people are paying their respects, in fact, to Erdogan's policy, because Erdogan from the beginning said, look, I'm part of NATO, Turkey's part of NATO, but I cannot condone this thing. So he fought the no-fly zone from the beginning. When he lost, okay, let's put it this way, the vote, he said, look, I'm going to work inside NATO to establish a humanitarian corridor, because this is a humanitarian problem above all. So now they're taking over the airport and the harbor in Benghazi to establish a humanitarian corridor. They are not. Turkey is not going to have a basis for NATO to attack northern Libya, or they're not going to send troops to combat in Libya. They are trying to do the humanitarian thing, which is the West, you know, as a whole, should have thought about from the beginning, or to have established a UN fact-finding instead of tomahawking. Establish a UN fact-finding commission. You can do this in one day in New York. Send these people to Libya and then establish the facts on the ground. How many times and what kind of aerial strikes Gaddafi unleashed over his own people when interviewed with survivors, you name it. At the same time, examining these allegations, some of them very strong, that black Africans were being massacred or raped or killed by the rebels themselves, because this plays into something that is never mentioned as well. There is, from the part of northern Arabs, there's extreme prejudice vis-a-vis black Africa. So a lot of people were instrumentalizing this prejudice to attack black Africans. And most of the black Africans in Libya, they're not mercenaries. These kinds of guys that take, trucks through the Sahara Desert from Chad or Niger, they travel for 3 or 4 days in the middle of the desert with very few water just to get to Libya to find a job. Because this is the only place in northern Africa for a black African with certain education that he can find a job. And there's also the reverse of the coin. Libya was playing cop on the beat to prevent illegal immigration from northern Africa to Europe, especially to France and
Italy.
France and Italian Mediterranean coast.
Now, right.
Look what happened this week. The island of Lampedusa in southern Italy, it's totally swamped by boats from all over the place, including boats coming from Libya, because now Libya is not the cop on the beat anymore. And they needed Libya to play that role. And Gaddafi obliged. because, you know, he was he had these contracts selling oil to French companies, Italian companies, German companies. So the whole setup is upside down.
Pepe, one thing, and I'm going to have to wrap up here in a couple of minutes, but okay. I wanted to ask you to inform our listeners about the composition beyond the colonel who spent all that time in Virginia. who are the rebels? And in particular, is Gaddafi accurate when he ties the eastern Libyan Muslim rebels to Al-Qaeda?
Yes. Okay. It's a motley crew. We have these people we discussed before, the exiles. We have military defectors who were working with Gaddafi in Tripoli, and some of them were colonels or captains in the Libyan army in the eastern part of Libya, in the Cyrenaica region. There is an element of the working class in Cyrenaica as well. It's important, but they are not represented in the INC, the Transitional Council. February 17 youth movement that I alluded before, students, internet-connected youth, intellectuals, university professors, basically educated but unemployed young people. And, you know, I was in touch with them from the beginning. And in the beginning, I was having the idea that they were the rebels, but not at all. Soon, they were completely marginalized by these people coming from the army, coming from inside the Gaddafi machine, which, okay, let's switch sides because we know which way the wind is blowing, and the exiles. And now they are totally marginalized. And, of course, there is, we cannot say that there is an Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb running things, not at all. The Al-Qaeda anywhere that you think, in Afpak, in the Maghreb, in the Arabic Peninsula, they are a fringe movement, and they don't have popular support, period. Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, they must have a maximum of 800 jihadis.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb is an Algerian organization, and they were expanding a little bit. Maybe they have designs of infiltrating into Egypt, because Ayman al-Zawahiri, as we all know, is Egyptian. You know, in Libya, their base is a city called Deraa, which is south of Benghazi.
Right.
That it's not an accident, in fact, because it's a very conservative place. We have Wahhabi imams in that area. There's huge unemployment. So what's a youngster in Deraa in that area to do? They listen to the Wahhabis. They enjoy jihad. They enroll in jihad, and they want to fight the West, probably Northern Africa, or some go to a training camp in the Waziristan. But we're talking about 25, 30, 40 people maximum. One of these guys, who was close to Osama bin Laden, by the way, he fought in the Afghan jihad. And then he was arrested in Peshawar in 2002, if I'm not mistaken. Then he was deported to Libya, and then he was released. And he settled in Cyrenaica. This guy is part of this Islamist fringe, is also part of the rebel. So we cannot, when Gaddafi says that Al-Qaeda is running the whole thing, it's completely wrong. But when we say that there is an Al-Qaeda fringe element, which will probably profit from this whole thing to extend their tentacles in eastern Libya, then we're getting closer to the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And the president of Chad already said that these people, they raided military warehouses in eastern Libya, and they may even have surface-to-air missiles. Nobody was able to confirm this from now, you know, Libyan press or Arabic press, but it's a strong possibility because, these warehouses in the east, for Gaddafi, they were essential because most of these tribes in the east, they were against him. He was not able to buy all of them. He used to play tribe against tribe. And this is a tribal revolt as well as a, let's say, revolutionary movement.
Indeed, and that's part of the challenge of the vacuum created. Without a designated replacement coming from the CIA in Langley, the idea that we would blow open Libya, toss out Gaddafi in one way or another, and just see what happens, that doesn't pass my own BS test.
No, it doesn't pass it's anybody's BS test. That's why, I'm astonished by the way progressives all over, I'm not talking only about U.S., but European progressives, South American progressives, progressives in Asia as well, they simply cannot understand that you can condemn both arrangements, the way Gaddafi runs Libya and the way humanitarian imperialists are winning this war. Both are completely wrong. There should have been a third way, and the third way would have been a UN commission, investigating commission, a ceasefire, and then let the Libyans decide themselves. That would be the only sensible solution for this, which is basically an internal civil war, which should be solved by Libyans themselves without Western intervention.
Pepe Escobar, you're doing great work. Thank you for joining me today. I learned a lot. And I want people to read your work at atimes.com. That's the Asia Times Online, atimes.com. And let me close with this quote from one of your recent articles. And this, you basically characterize America's position. If you sell us a lot of oil, buy our weapons, and smash Al-Qaeda, that's fine with us. You may even kill your own people, provided it's just dozens, not thousands. Pepe, you've got a great view and a stunning analysis from outside the United States, and I really appreciate your perspective and our ability to share that with my listeners.
Peter, it was an enormous pleasure, as always, and it's a very sad and tragic process that we're living at the moment, and I hope it doesn't get as nearly as tragic as what happened in Iraq.
Indeed, Pepe. We'll stay in touch. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks very much. Take care. Thank you.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. In a moment, Robert Parry with another view of America's intervention in Libya. Robert Parry returns to our program today. He publishes at consortiumnews.com, a nonprofit journalism site that's been publishing for, more than 15 years now. And he also is the author of Neck Deep, a three-book set about the history of the Bush dynasty in the United States. And I encourage you to read his work and support the effort at consortiumnews.com. Bob Parry, good to talk with you again. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Peter.
You didn't get to hear Pepe Escobar's comments, but you're familiar with that globe-trotting reporter, and he brought us some very interesting information in the first segment of our podcast today. I wanted to ask you to help us analyze the politics here in the United States related to this new military adventure, which Obama doesn't want to call a war. It is a kinetic military operation, and it's new and improved over the way, for example, George W. Bush would have done it, because there is a UN authorization. They have developed an alleged coalition. No ground troops, particularly no American ground troops, are contemplated, and no messy occupation is contemplated at this stage of this international effort. First of all, what is your sense of where the support comes from for Obama's participation in this kind of half-hearted effort? We're not going to liberate Libya from Gaddafi. The mission is to safeguard the civilians and, I guess, support the rebels, but that's subject to some squabbling interpretation of UN Resolution 1973.
Well, I think Gaddafi did bring a little bit of this on himself when he used rather bellicose rhetoric, vowing to crush his opponents in the East, and going door to door, showing no mercy, et cetera, et cetera. And that created the impression that there might well be a massacre when Gaddafi got to Benghazi, when his troops got to Benghazi. The side of this that the U.S. media has been very slow in picking up is that Gaddafi did have a point when he even sent a letter to President Obama saying, I'm dealing here with Al-Qaeda type terrorists, and he asked President Obama, well, how would you deal with that if some of them took over cities in your country? Now that's obviously a bit self-serving, but there is some truth to it. There was a study done based on captured Al-Qaeda documents by the West Point Center Against Terrorism, and that study discovered that that one of the real hotbeds for jihadists going to Iraq and even Afghanistan and committing suicide bombings was from this eastern section of Libya, particularly at a town near Benghazi and Benghazi itself, where the highest per capita number of terrorists were joining Al-Qaeda's ranks for the war in Iraq. So there wasn't entirely false what Gaddafi was saying, although clearly there's good reason or valid reasons for many people to be opposed to Gaddafi. But Gaddafi made things worse for himself with his rhetoric. And so Obama may not have had much of a choice in terms of trying to stop what some people thought might be a human rights catastrophe. However, from there on, there becomes a much more serious question in terms of the United States and its NATO allies not just intervening to protect a certain area of the civilian population, but essentially providing almost close air support for the advancing of the rebel forces into western Libya. And there again, you have the core fact that the Obama administration and the Western press corps don't really seem to know who is the Libyan opposition. Clearly, there are some people that can be put in suits and be well presented to the world community, and I'm sure that's somewhat legitimate. But it's also understood that there are elements that are much less savory than that, and possibly if one were to arm them and then help guide them across Libya, the idea of protecting civilians might be turned on its head. The last thing you might want is to have some vengeful thinking people from eastern Libya who are caught up in a kind of a jihadist fury going into Tripoli, for instance. So it's obviously a very complex situation, and one in which the United States has not been entirely forthcoming to the public, and the U.S. news media has not been very honest about the complexities of this either.
Well, and to your point about Al-Qaeda in eastern Libya, Pepe Escobar, who was on just before you, acknowledged that that is a fact, and that there are, he says, 800, tops 1,000 jihadists in that part of Libya. He also, like you, points to the town of Darna, which is a Wahhabi center and has produced some known suicide bombers in Iraq and Afghanistan. That said, Gaddafi's use of Al-Qaeda as a reason for his crackdown on his own people and the pro-democracy protesters in Tripoli, who appear to have absolutely no connection to Al-Qaeda or even to some of the other loosely knit rebel forces in eastern Libya, that was the focal point of his crackdown, of Gaddafi's crackdown. And certainly there was, in my view, legitimate concern about what Gaddafi's forces would do if they were permitted to roll into Benghazi, and also with air support from the small air force that Gaddafi does or did have before the international intervention. But there's so many unanswered questions in the explanations provided by the president and the White House as to what we hope will happen when we hope that Gaddafi just disappears, because we're only hoping because it can't be part of the mission because the coalition would have fractured. And so Obama is in this very difficult position. And I do respect the sensitivities that he's trying to deal with, not only with Libya, but with other Arab dictator nations that we support as on the other hand. So as we look at this, I see Obama as not really leveling with the American people about critical issues as to who will take over the country and how this destabilization and removal of Gaddafi can be achieved without some sort of foreign on-the-ground military presence.
Well, I think that's, that makes a lot of sense, that at least to the degree that you'd have foreign trainers going in with weapons to arm and get the rebels up to a fighting form, so they can actually do a march to the west. They seem to hop in their cars and drive out there until a shell lands nearby, and they turn around and be back. So it does seem like if that's the route that the NATO coalition decides to follow, you're going to need something like that. The larger problem, though, to me, is that we've ended up with all this essentially confused history about this region. And the demonizing of Gaddafi, while some of it is deserved, has also become sort of a made-up piece of our history, a part of our history. For instance, the case that was involved in the Pan Am 103 bombing is extremely weak.
Yes, it is.
One might even call ludicrous.
Yes.
I'm not sure if anyone's actually read the Scottish court's finding where they convicted this guy Megrahi, who was a Israeli intelligence agent. They basically had two Libyans facing charges, and they kind of were under enormous political pressure, as they've acknowledged since, to convict somebody. So they had this highly implausible scenario that they followed, with an extremely dubious eyewitness on Megrahi, and they let the co-defendant go, found him innocent, but they found Megrahi guilty, and locked him away. Now Megrahi was almost the case against him was so weak that eventually the Scottish Appeals Court agreed in 2007 to look at this as a miscarriage of justice. And basically, the eyewitness who was a guy who owned a store in Malta who supposedly sold Megrahi a shirt that ended up in the suitcase where the bomb was. It was such an implausible belief that guy was providing a realistic ID, because he'd given contrary IDs before he actually saw Megrahi, that they were looking at this to throw it out. But in 2009, as you know, instead of having that procedure go all the way through, Megrahi was diagnosed to have prostate cancer and was allowed to be freed on humanitarian grounds. In the meantime, Libya was confronted with a severe set of sanctions because of the Megrahi conviction and this assertion that they were behind the Pan Am 103 bombing. Again, I think to Gaddafi's discredit, he agreed to take responsibility for something that they privately say they didn't do, and they paid off some of the families of the victims of Pan Am 103, but they were sort of branded. They allowed themselves to be branded as the culprits behind this terrorist attack. So now when we come to what's happening today, you'll see this across the board. The New York Times reports as a matter of flat fact that Libya downed the Pan Am 103.
Right.
You watch NBC, Andrea Mitchell will simply say, we all know that in December of 1988, Libya downed the Pan Am 103. So you have this sort of belief that is not based in reality, or it's based in certainly a very murky, you know, who knows kind of situation, but is accepted as true. And that then drives a part of this narrative, which is that Gaddafi is someone who has engaged in that level of terrorism. So he's not just a dictator who's been oppressive to his people, but someone who goes and blows people out of the sky. Now, you know, again, we end up with a situation that the answer to that, I guess, becomes you have to get rid of this guy, that he's incorrigible, he must be destroyed. And so the possibilities of some kind of negotiated settlement, some kind of ceasefire, some kind of coalition government, perhaps, which does bring about reform, mm-hmm. is kind of thrown aside.
Right.
And yet that presents probably the best option, where you have tribes in the East who are hostile to tribes in the West and vice versa, and where probably the only answer is to figure out some way to get these two sides to sit down and work something out. And if Gaddafi is or isn't part of the mix, you know, so be it. The key thing is to get some kind of reform to this country and to bring about some peace. But that seems now to be not part of the discussion. It has to be that Gaddafi must go, and even if that's going to infuriate some of his supporters, and he clearly still has significant support in Tripoli among his own tribe and some other tribes, tribes he has favored with the oil revenue, by the way.
Right, and he continues to pass out cash to them just in recent weeks.
Right. So you have this situation where, because of the sort of murky and false history that we've adopted as the American narrative, we can't really do what perhaps is the best thing to do in Libya.
Well, and Bob, I'm glad you've referenced Pan Am 103 and the demonization of Gaddafi. He's an easy figure to caricature, and really going back to Poppy Bush with Noriega, we've had a series of these super villains presented on our television screens with partial information, which is clearly very damaging. And it puts people in an awkward spot because nobody wants to be defending Muammar Gaddafi.
Right.
And he is so indefensible that it's easy for neocons and others to project this huge image of him as the currently most evil person on the planet. And, you know, this puts anybody who asks objective questions in a difficult spot, because of the emotional baggage that they're able to deploy around Gaddafi to justify virtually anything. And so it's a foregone conclusion that Gaddafi must go. That's not a disputable point. That's not something that can be debated in the West right now.
That's right. And I think that is a danger. We've seen it. Of course, this is not a new phenomenon, but it's been refined in recent decades by the neocons in particular, whether it was Danny Ortega in Nicaragua, or Fidel Castro in Cuba, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. You almost go down this list of people that the United States has demonized through the media. And not to say that there aren't a lot of bad sides to those people or things that we all would criticize.
Oh, come on, you're defending evildoers.
But,
there you know,
you go. That's true, I am. But I would say that, you know, if you actually looked objectively at some of this, you would say, well, are any of these people worse than, say, George W. Bush was in terms of launching wars or being aggressive against countries that weren't threatening their country, or how they behaved toward people who were in their prisons? You have to sort of, but we do this selectively. We sort of have certain people who are defended no matter what they do, i.e., something like Bush, and then people who are demonized even when they do things that are much sort of less severe. And if anyone tries to say, hold it, let's if we're going to be objective as journalists, if we're going to be honest as people, citizens looking at these things, let's apply common standards. But we can't do that. That's out of the question. And if you do so, you're an apologist. It's always you're an Ortega apologist or a Castro apologist or a Saddam Hussein apologist, and that's the phrasing they use to sort of then disqualify you from the debate. And so they control the debate through this kind of bullying tactic,
mm-hmm.
that anybody who doesn't go along with the narrative that they've set up, that often is partially true but partially false or largely false even, has to be thrown out of the debate. And so you have the famous line in 84 at the Republican convention from Gene Kirkpatrick, that these are people who blame America first.
Right.
Anybody who sort of sees reason to criticize American foreign policy is someone who blames America first. And you have this ugliness that is used to frame the debate in a way that then leads to decisions that are often extremely violent and get a lot of innocent people killed, and really don't even achieve often the goal of the people doing it. You have the situation like in Iraq where this sort of approach was used with Saddam Hussein, it's almost the same thing as we're seeing now with Gaddafi, where he had to leave, and if he didn't leave, you know, the invasion would follow. But the invasion ended up not serving even the interest the neocons thought they were serving. They were getting rid of this longtime enemy of Israel, in their view, and of the United States. And instead, what they ended up with was essentially a Shiite version, kind of Saddam Hussein and Maliki, with Iran having a lot more influence in Iraq. They've gotten rid of this bulwark against Iranian influence into the region.
Yep.
So it's almost like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, where they sort of stir up the trouble and don't know where it's going to go and then can't control it. I mean, similarly now we're faced, I think, in Libya with this question. It's a legitimate question that even people like former Governor Palin has raised. Who are these people that we're now throwing our support behind, and what if they end up being a lot worse or as bad as Gaddafi? And what if we end up with Libya being influenced, or if not controlled, by extremists of the Al Qaeda persuasion? Then what? So then I guess we'd have to invade because we couldn't let that happen. So we end up sort of setting these things in motion without, we even talk about, it's not clear what the end game is, but the American press is not even discussing what the real end game could be.
Well, and in addition, I don't think that we have a clear view of the multiple motivations. And here's where I bring in Saudi Arabia to this discussion. Because King Abdullah has a long-term beef with Gaddafi. And the Saudis are very interested in quashing the regional aspirations for freedom and even, ultimately, in some cases, democracy. And in Bahrain, it appears that this is playing out in a proxy manner, where the United States appears to have supported the deployment of Saudi troops and police to Bahrain within 48 hours of Bob Gates' most recent visit there. And that Saudi Arabia has responded by supporting, through the Arab League and the Gulf Council, the U.S.-led NATO coalition airstrikes over Libya. And so it is part of a regional chessboard, and I don't believe the American media is giving Americans a full view of that.
I think that's right. I mean, a point I've made in one of my articles at consortiumnews.com was that when is an invasion an invasion? Even if, in the case of Bahrain, the king of Bahrain, who is obviously part of a minority, a Sunni minority controlling a Shiite majority, he summons or invites whatever word you want to call it the Saudis to come in and help him put down this pro-democracy effort, which, if it were allowed to play out, presumably would have given the Shiites more power because they have their numbers. So that happens. Now, similarly, let's say, if you want to historically go back, when the communist regime in Kabul, Afghanistan, was in trouble back in 1979, they invited some elements of it, invited the Soviet military in to support them. They were fighting some Islamic fundamentalists at the time, the Mujahideen. And that was an invasion. We all agree. That's an invasion. But when Saudi Arabia pours its troops into Bahrain, read the New York Times. It's anything but an invasion. It's an invitation. It's an arrival. It's
maneuvers.
All these different words. And even when Iran claimed that's an invasion, the New York Times said basically mocked Iran for calling it an invasion. It was like Iran even called it an invasion, as if that's the craziest thing you could ever imagine. So you have this problem where the United States press doesn't behave objectively. Objective journalism, which is what we supposedly promote, is in effect applied differently. And when you have different standards to situations depending on what the geopolitics is, you're not being objective. You're just playing word games. And so what we've ended up with is a whole bunch of propaganda and word games and manipulation of the public around these questions and selective outrage. So certain outrage falls in one area, and in others it's excused or it's not that important, and we and the U.S. government, or particularly the media now, doesn't get as riled up.
Well, and it is a confusing political landscape in the United States because on the far right, you have Newt Gingrich, who wants to put aside his passion for women and American politics to be our president. And he was first critical of Obama for moving too slowly, and now he has found reasons to oppose what Obama's chosen to do. And on the other end of the spectrum, my friend Dennis Kucinich is, in my view, properly challenging the president over the issues of congressional authority and the War Powers Resolution. And in the middle, I think there are a lot of people who are being led along by what we've just described, the demonization of Gaddafi, the inevitability of his removal, and then it's okay, how do we accomplish this? We're seeing the polls are pretty much evenly divided, that Americans do have questions about this, and that not all Democrats are on board behind President Obama's newest war.
Right. I think with some of the Republicans, I mean, there are some that are speaking from some consistency and principle, but a lot of them are simply trying to find whatever Obama's done and take the opposite position, even to the point of Gingrich having been for the no-fly zone before baiting Obama to do it. When Obama did it, then it became a bad idea. So you have these people going back and forth depending on where Obama is, not in terms of what a sensible policy might be. That said, I do think, as you say, there are serious questions about the authorities of Congress versus the executive. Obama, I think, to his credit, though, did it in taking the time. He is not acting in the unilateral fashion that Bush did. There was a UN resolution.
I agree.
By the Security Council, whether one likes this or not, as a way of doing things, this is how the international law is set up. There was, I think, a legitimate case that there could have been a massacre of a lot of innocent people. So I think there was a basis for the UN resolution, and I think, to some limited level, the United States getting involved made some sense as part of this larger coalition. Now, that, however, is now being tested, it seems, by this desire being pushed heavily by the neocons, but also by elements of the Obama administration, particularly Secretary of State Clinton and some others, that the United States must go in deeper, that the United States must be part of, or at least work with NATO allies to arm and train the Libyan rebels and sort of send them off in a conquest of Tripoli. Now that is a whole different beast in I think in terms of how we should view this. It's a much riskier thing. It raises the question of another kind of massacre of civilians, not done on behalf of the pro-U.S. side as opposed to the anti-U.S. side, if that's how one wants to look at it. But that becomes the difficulty. But I think in terms of the War Powers Act, Obama has generally followed it. He may, if he reduces the U.S. role, or may be able to get a resolution also through Congress. He probably has to do that at some point. There's a certain time limit. But the War Powers Act has been largely ignored, as you know, especially by Republican presidents, but by some Democrats too.
Yes.
Since it took effect after Vietnam, the basic view of the two Bush presidents was that they did not need any kind of authorization. They did ultimately seek it, but their view was they didn't need it. They could have operated unilaterally, both in terms of the U.S. Congress and in terms of the U.N. They didn't need the U.N. approval either. And in fact, in the case of the invasion of Iraq, despite what Bush's people keep saying, he did not have approval from the U.N. to invade Iraq. It's a continuous lie that they tell when they say that the previous U.N. resolution, which called for inspectors to go in, authorized the invasion. It did not, and in fact, Bush, when he was faced with defeat at the Security Council, pulled the resolution for the invasion and went with the coalition of the willing. But that's another false part of our history now that's been sort of put in play and repeated over and over again, that Bush did get U.N. approval to invade Iraq.
Well, Bob, I would offer that, like so many things, Obama is doing this better than Bush would have, and many of the facets you mentioned are true, that he did this in a timely manner. It took Clinton over a year to get a resolution to do the aerial bombardments over Bosnia. We dithered for years over Haiti. And so there was little dithering here, and I appreciate that on its own. Also, I think that Obama has the sense that he can conduct wars with limited damage to his own political popularity, because we see the contradiction right now that more than two-thirds of Americans, which includes many Republicans, are opposed to continuing our military presence in Afghanistan. Yet it doesn't appear to cost the president any significant political capital because of the way the issue falls on Capitol Hill, that Republicans are silently supporting the president and Democrats are silently silenced but seething in many cases over this policy. And so I think the president has been emboldened that he can take certain military actions without paying a political price.
Well, I think that's partly true. I think the I think he has lost a lot of his Democratic base, however, over these things. I mean, if what I hear about, and obviously it's somewhat anecdotal, but I get a lot of emails at conservativenews.com, and believe me, they tend to be fairly critical of Obama for continuing and expanding the war in Afghanistan. They've been a little bit more divided, it seems, or not as vocal on the issue of Libya, because I think it's a little confusing to a lot of people, but. But I think Obama has cost himself a lot of support in his base, which showed up in 2010 with the Republican surge. A lot of it seems to me a lot of progressives stayed home.
Yeah.
They felt it wasn't worth voting for the Democrats or fighting for that,
mm-hmm.
and that helped the Republicans to some degree or another win their big big election victory in November. So I do think it has hurt the president. In terms of his politics, you're right about, I think, Congress, that it's hard to picture the Democratic members rebelling so much that they would strip him of power to do these things. And the Republicans are in a mixed situation. They have to continue, in a way, supporting Bush's wars. They haven't really turned against them in a clear way.
And I'm not the first, Bob, to point out that members of both parties on Capitol Hill don't really want to take a vote on this, because they're not sure how it'll play out at the next election, and many of them, including Hillary Clinton, were burned by their support for Bush's invasion of Iraq.
Right. I do think one of the problems that Obama made for himself was right after the election in 2008, when he chose to, I think for sort of tactical political reasons, or something he thought was clever, to surround himself with people who were either part of Bush's national security establishment, i.e., Defense Secretary Gates, the high command at the Pentagon. There were no real changes there made. They were significant. And then he brought in Hillary Clinton, who was sort of a neocon light, if you will, to be Secretary of State. That seemed like a smart play in terms of Democratic of coalition building, but ended up putting a lot of folks in key positions who were in favor of this kind of American interventionism and war fighting around the world. So I think he was then unable to maneuver much. If you read Woodward's book, Obama's Wars, what you're left with is that Obama is somewhat a reluctant warrior who is sort of looking for options that he's not being given. He didn't seem to understand that if you put in powerful people who are opposed to you to what you may want to do, it's very difficult to just persuade them to do it, because they have their own agenda, they have their own constituency, they have their own interests, and so they operate in a way that is meant to confine you and control you, even if you're president. Now, and I think that's what we saw come out of the Afghan debate, when basically the options were you're going to have to send 30 to 40,000 more troops to Afghanistan, Mr. President. And he wasn't able to find a basis to resist that. If he had gone against all this advice, he would have suffered heavily politically inside the Beltway, inside Washington, because he would have gone against Hillary, he would have gone against Gates, he would have gone against Petraeus, he would have gone against the Pentagon brass, and that would have been very damaging for him. So he took the option of sort of giving them more or less what they wanted, with a few caveats here and there, like charting the withdrawal in July of 2011 to sort of try to appease his base. But those are the kinds of problems you get if you don't really come in with a desire for change. When you come in with this idea that, well, we'll do continuity so we don't upset the apple cart, the Washington apple cart, I mean, I know it's hard to upset it, because if you upset it, there are consequences too. But if you don't upset it, there are consequences. And some of those consequences were paid in 2010.
And Bob, you wrote a piece that was published on March 29 called Warriors of the Mainstream Media. And in it, you point out that the New York Times and the Washington Post have been not only cheerleading for military action, but critical of the president for moving too slowly.
Right. Both these major newspapers, I guess the two preeminent newspapers in the United States, have taken a more belligerent position. And the Washington Post, we should be frank, has evolved into the preeminent neoconservative outlet for information in the country. Its editorial pages are just overwhelmingly neocon. There are a couple of voices here or there that maybe represent a different view, but its editorial positions are neocon, and a large chunk of its columnists are neocons.
Mm-hmm.
And they present that kind of view, and it's very biased. It's very one-sided. It's often false. And that's what they do. The New York Times is moving in that direction increasingingly under the executive editor Bill Keller, who amazingly in 2003, when he wasn't executive editor, when he was just a columnist for the magazine there, came out and bought every single lie you could possibly buy relating to Bush's Iraq war argument and the stuff that Colin Powell sold at the UN. He got everything wrong. Did a very influential piece for the New York Times Magazine, as I'm surprised I'm a hawk kind of piece, and after having egg on his face for being completely wrong, was then elevated to the top news job at the New York Times, executive editor.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of shows you the kind of consequences that you don't get if you go with the flow here and support the neocon kind of position. You're elevated, and it's increasingly true, I think, of their editorial pages that you're starting to see that. We're seeing prominent liberals disappear. Frank Rich is gone. Bob Herbert's gone just in the past couple of weeks. Their voices are not being replaced, as far as I can tell, by anyone like that. So here are these two preeminent publications that help set the agenda in Washington, and they are certainly moving in this neocon way, baiting Obama at times for not being more belligerent and muscular, criticized, basically accepting facts as things that aren't true as fact. Like I mentioned, the New York Times and it's stating as unquestioned that Libya shot down, blew up Pan Am 103. These kinds of things are now becoming pervasive in these publications, and that's a very dangerous development, because what they say is kind of accepted by much of the commentariat class in Washington as a basis to work from, and if they're getting things this wrong on this kind of serious topic, as we saw in 2002 and 2003, as the New York Times did on Iraq, as the Washington Post editorials did on Iraq, that has life and death consequences. And it also has severe consequences for the future of the country, but we're seeing that happen, and we're not seeing the kind of pushback that would be needed to get these newspapers or get some alternative news organizations to be strong enough to put forward alternative and more accurate positions, information, and opinions.
And Bob, in your article, you cite the Washington Post's rather belligerent position against the Obama administration because it's not in sync sufficiently with the policies of the state of Israel. And as someone who supports the aspirations of the Palestinian people, it's really hard for me to read the language that the Post uses, describing Obama as a barrier to Mideast peace and the headline asking whose side is he on, and saying that Netanyahu has to try to manage Barack Obama. And this, you know, at least in recent weeks, has revolved around the U.S. veto of a Security Council resolution at the U.N., which would have condemned Israel for continuing to build settlements on the West Bank in disputed territories. And this is one of those issues where the Zionist view is that Israel can do whatever it wants and that the Palestinians are the problem here and all the issues are shifted to their side of the ledger. And this really pins Obama down because he's been a very strong supporter of Israel, turned a blind eye to the commission report on the atrocities that Israel inflicted on Gaza just weeks before Obama took the oath of office. And so it's remarkable to me that these two leading newspapers are so aggressive in trying to corner the president into completing the foreign policy initiatives, not of the United States, but of the state of Israel.
Yeah, I think that is a serious problem. And it's also been underscored by this remarkable story, which has gotten much too little attention in my view, which is that the Knesset held a special hearing, a kind of McCarthyite hearing in Jerusalem, where they essentially summoned this group J Street.
Yeah, Ben Ami.
Right, which is an organization of American Jews who are supportive of Israel but criticize some of Israel's actions. And one thing that they took a stand on was they felt there that the U.S. should have gone along with that with the resolution at the U.N. which it vetoed, condemning these expansions of these settlements as an obstacle to peace. Because of that and other criticisms, rather mild criticism, J Street has made of the Likud government over there, they were essentially summoned, called on the carpet by this Likud-run committee at the Knesset, and told that they did not get in line behind everything that the Israeli government did, they would be deemed anti-Israel and pro-Palestinian, and therefore be shut out from American synagogues and other Jewish organizations. The Washington Post, even in reporting on this, made what I guess they considered a fairly uncontroversial statement that this view is that American Jews have no choice or should have no choice. That it's almost treasonous for American Jews to criticize anything that the Israeli government does. That their role is to simply support whatever the Israeli government does. And we're seeing that kind of attitude through the neocons become pervasive in Washington. And there has been some pushback, but people who try to sort of take a more even-handed or realistic approach, like Ambassador Chaz Freeman, for instance, who was essentially blackballed from being the someone overseeing American intelligence analysis because he was considered too even-handed on the Middle East and wasn't pro-Israeli enough. That kind of attitude of demonizing anybody who won't go along with this is a very dangerous phenomenon, and one that I frankly don't think is good for Israel. I think what it ultimately creates is this sort of intimidated a Washington political reality that will eventually, may eventually lead to certain anger among the American people, where the neocons want to act in a way that they consider favorable to Israel, but may not end up being favorable to the American public, particularly like something like the war in Iraq, which the neocons, I guess, thought was what the Israelis wanted because they've been sort of angry about Saddam Hussein for all those years. And so the United States, so you took kids from from Tennessee or Idaho and send them off to kill Arabs in Iraq. But the ultimate outcome wasn't even good for Israel. Essentially, yeah. You ended up with a government in Iraq that probably is closer to the Iranians, much closer to the Iranians than Saddam Hussein was, certainly, and destabilized the region. But still, this idea that we have elements of the Israeli government thinking that if an American Jewish organization doesn't march in lockstep with what the Likud tell them, that they're going to be punished and berated and essentially treated as traitors. This is a very offensive and even dangerous phenomenon.
I share your concern, Bob. I'm aware of J Street. I've interviewed Mr. Ben-Ami, who is the founder of the group. I applaud their entry into the debate and dialogue regarding U.S. support for Israeli policies. And I consider them moderate, to a moderate degree. And they have been, I think, very careful in trying to strike a tone that would not be seen as threatening to the Israeli government. But I got this little snapshot. Last year, a couple of weeks before our midterm elections, I had an email exchange with a guy in Jerusalem named Ted Bellman. And as it happens, I get emails from him almost every day. He does a listserv, and he calls it Isra Pundit. And he was disseminating lists to his American subscribers recommending votes against certain members of the Senate and the House because they had attended a dinner held by J Street. And I found this really flabbergasting. And so I gently pointed out to Mr. Bellman in an email that I was offended that, as an Israeli, he was trying to tell Americans how to vote, and that by simply smearing people because they attended a dinner, this is not that they signed a letter endorsing everything J Street believes in, there was no manifesto, they went to a dinner at J Street, or held by J Street, and this was seen as a reason for Jewish American voters and their allies to defeat at the polls people who were seen as too soft on Israel. And I suggested to Mr. Bellman that not only was it misplaced for him to try to tell Americans how to vote, but that I thought J Street was doing a good job of bringing forward issues that needed to be discussed and debated. And he responded in a blistering screed, which basically says that if you support J Street, you may as well join Hamas. And so there is no middle ground. There is no opportunity to offer levels of support for Israel. There's really only one level of support, and that's total. And if you don't achieve that, then you're part of the enemy.
Yeah, I'm afraid that is some of the view. I mean, I've spent a good deal of time in Israel, certainly not all that recently, but in the 90s I was there quite a bit. And, I have great fondness for the country and the people. And you can see parts of this beginning to really take hold, this kind of extremism. Then there was still a bit more of an open debate there. Actually, the debate there was probably more open than it was in the United States about Israel. But you still had this attitude that you're with us or you're against us, and there wasn't. And if you didn't accept this idea, this notion that the Bible grants control over all these territories and that the Palestinians are somehow intruders, you were somehow the enemy, and that was you had to be excluded. And it became more difficult to sort of have rational debates about what's best for the people of that region, both the Jews and the Muslims, because if you're taking kind of this religious approach, where you live by these myths of from centuries and millennia ago, that's going to be determinative on the that's the answer to the question, then there really isn't much debate besides how do you get rid of the people who are in your way.
Well, and it also
that's quite troubling.
It undermines any belief that Israel is really committed to a peace process. Because that, in you know, there's no way around compromise and dialogue if you're really interested in peace. And the hardliners in Israel are doing everything they can to prevent any dialogue from developing. And unfortunately, the Palestinians in recent weeks have been conducting more rocket attacks and playing into the hands of those Israeli hardliners. I understand they do it out of desperation and frustration, but it doesn't change the calculus or the chemistry.
No, it doesn't. But I think you know you have this this situation where we know that President Abbas offered major concessions, according to these documents that were released by Al Jazeera, that really infuriated many of his own people, and the Israelis weren't going to move on it. But the Washington Post, editorial pages report on that, they claim that Abbas has been unwilling to make concessions. The Washington Post simply lies at this point. They ignore what the evidence is that's actually been presented, documents that are out there and people know about. But the Washington Post position is, at least in its editorial section, is that those concessions never existed, that Abbas has refused to make any concessions, and that the Israelis are the ones who've been so reasonable. And when you're getting into this kind of false narrative, just outright deception, on behalf of a political ideological interest, and that has now pervaded deeply into a publication and an organization like the Washington Post, you have a serious problem on your hands. And I think the American people have not responded adequately in terms of the point we've talked about before, Peter, is the need to build alternative media that will tell the truth, that will not be intimidated, that refuses to be intimidated by all this pressure. That has not happened, as we're now decades into this process, and we still don't see that happening. And I'm not quite sure why. These problems are not going to solve themselves.
Yeah. Well, Bob, thank you for joining me today. Great discussion. And I want people to read your work and the work of many other great reporters who you publish at consortiumnews.com.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this latest episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Share it with a friend and then email peter@peterbcollins.com. I'd love to hear from you.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until